This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Sundance Now. Keep an ear out for a promo code that'll save you money on your next true crime obsession. Thanks for supporting Blotter Presents sponsors and for listening. And now, our episode. Everyone remembers that Mary Tyler Moore played narcissistic grifter slash worst mom ever candidate Sontae Kimes. Nobody remembers that she also played narcissistic baby stealer slash racist Georgia Tan in a 1993 Lifetime movie. Well, except the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, which gave her an Emmy for it, and me and Piper Weiss, who are going to talk about stolen babies. Later, Kevin Smokler talks to criminal and This Is Love host and creator Phoebe Judge about Georgia Tan, narrative control, and the changing landscape of true crime podcasts. Don't sign that surrender contract before you listen to The Blotter Presents, episode 142. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast discussing how true crime is told and sold. Returning as my guest today is one of my favorite tellers, the author of You All Grow Up and Leave Me, Piper Weiss. Hello, Piper. How are you?
Hi, Sarah. I'm all right, all things considered.
Yeah. And well, there's really only the one thing to consider. How's your cough?
It is, knock on wood, better.
I am glad to hear that.
Yeah. Feeling all right. Getting my sense of smell back slowly but surely.
So it takes that long to come back, man.
No, I mean, like, for me, it is just like every day I take the curry powder and shove it under my nose and I'm like, I think I can smell it.
Oh, man. Well, I'm glad you're mostly on the other side of that.
Yeah.
Knock wood. If you had wound up at the Tennessee Children's Home in Memphis, you probably just would have been left in a crib to cope. We're about to talk about it in the cold case section. In the inimitable style of Lifetime movies, past and current, this one is just bluntly titled Stolen Babies. It aired in March of 1993. Here's the case file from the IMDb. Quote, a 1940s Tennessee welfare worker learns that Georgia Tan, the charismatic head of a local adoption agency, is actually running a black market baby ring behind the Tennessee Children's Home Society. End quote. Tennessee misspelled both times. In that summary, come on, guys. Leah Thompson's welfare worker named Annie faces off against Mary Tyler Moore's Georgia Tan and the Memphis power structure, including Kathleen Quinlan in a winning, if badly accented, performance as Annie's rich and later compromised friend Becca, when it becomes clear Tan is colluding with local judge Camille Kelly to profit from shady, if not outright illegal, adoptions. Tan is thought to have clearinghoused more than 5,000 children. Wikipedia notes that, quote, notable personalities who used Tan's services included actress Joan Crawford, June Allison and husband Dick Powell, and the adoptive parents of professional wrestler Ric Flair. That's a lot. Okay. Piper, before we talk about the movie qua movie, had you heard or did you know anything about this case prior to watching it?
I had not. I had known nothing about it. I also turned to Wikipedia for support. And I found it really interesting that the Wikipedia page is very much written like dialogue in the movie, which is just like heavy Southern movie accent. And even like the Wikipedia page about Georgia Tan is like, she despised playing piano and instead desired to become a lawyer as her father had been. Under tutelage, she read the law. However, her father did not want her to practice law because it was so unusual for women. I'm just like, I think the screenwriter wrote this Wikipedia page.
Yeah. Could have been. I knew nothing about this either. I was inspired to read up on it, and then I picked this movie because later on in the episode, we'll be talking to Criminal host and co-creator Phoebe Judge, and interviewer Kevin Smokler asked her specifically about the Georgia Tan episode of Criminal and how it may have inspired her to betray more of her personal feeling about her subject than usual. So I was like, okay, Mary Tyler Moore played Georgia Tan, but I wasn't really expecting much of anything because it's a Lifetime movie and you're like, they're kind of in on the joke now, but 25 or 30 years ago, no. So I thought this was surprisingly good compared to what I was expecting, without exactly rising to the level of good. What did you think of it?
I mean, I thought it was a little bit of a misdirect in the beginning because I was just like, oh, this is going to be like Steel Magnolias and Fried Green Tomatoes. And just like, it is not, spoiler alert, it is a very serious topic and not at all lady empowering in like a late 80s Southern way.
No, no, it isn't.
And I was like, hello, Lifetime. I did not see that coming. But yeah, I mean, I love me some Mary Tyler Moore. Good to see Leah Thompson during her Carolyn in the City era.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Which is about as accurate a rendering of New York City as these accents are accurate to Tennessee. Like, hers is not so bad, but Mary Tyler Moore's and Kathleen Quinlan especially, like, I mean, I love me some KQ, but girl, come on.
It's rough. It's pretty rough. It's definitely, and it was just also that, like, that era where it was just like, if you want to act in Hollywood and are a woman, you have to have this weird accent that nobody ever had, you know, just like,
that's that you're like gargling with Katherine Hepburn. Totally. Yep.
And just everything Julia Roberts in that era.
Oh, blush and bashful.
Yep.
Brutal. I'm going to play a clip in which, I think this scene in which basically this Georgia Tan's whole scam, well, she had a bunch of scams. Part of her scam was like reassuring poor couples that she would place their kids temporarily so that they'd have enough to eat and the parents could like go to the coast and get work. And then when the parents came back, it was like, whoops, I adopted out your kid. The records are sealed. Shrug. He's better off with a rich family. And it's like, well, that's not how that works legally, emotionally. But this scene really gave me this, like, it just reminded me of like The Handmaid's Tale and just her whole, like, it just smacks of like revisionist economic eugenics. It's bad. But here she is explaining to, the naive Annie why the kid should not be basically repatriated to its birth parents in clip two. Yeah, a little accent slip there, but also the Eddie in question ends up getting adopted out to Kathleen Quinlan's character. And then there's a very moist, conflicted ending in which he has to, like, I guess she gives the baby back. I don't think this was that part of it was based on a real life case, but occasionally this movie got at, like, it was able to look directly at the really disgusting parts of this in a way that I felt was unexpected. And if you could kind of tune out the inept Tennessee accentry, it was more affecting and interesting than I expected. Would you agree, or did you find everything else too distracting?
I would agree. I did zone out. Okay, I'm lying. I don't agree. I found it was, you know what, it might have been just like the poor quality of like the YouTube link, or just like,
yeah, there is one whole scene where like the VCR is trying to track.
Yes. Yeah.
you just can't see anything.
Nostalgic in that way. Like, I actually, like, maybe another movie it would have even held more of my interest because it had that like kind of au naturel aspect. But yeah, I was definitely going in and out of attention. But maybe that's on me. I mean, the story itself is horrifying and riveting. But did they get to anything about Tan's lover, Anne Atwood?
No.
I don't think there is like no. There's no touching on the fact that she worked with the woman who then became her like quote unquote like Boston marriage wife.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that was maybe, I think they were like, you know, unless this is a mini series, and I think Lifetime was like not ready to go there.
Right. Right.
Maybe if this had been on like NBC.
Yep.
They would have tried it, but I think Lifetime was like, you know, lady parts touching other lady parts, like that's, you know, no, we're not doing that.
Not on my network. Yes. Yeah. But yeah, I there was like almost a like a human aspect that was maybe missing, that is like as horrible as Georgia Tan was, of just like, it just seemed like it was one of those movies that kind of paints villains as straight up villains. Not to say that Georgia Tan wasn't a straight up villain, but like, I don't know. There's just like, I feel like her story is so insane based on my Wikipedia research that I kind of like, I wanted a full focus on her, as opposed to like, I didn't need the Leia Thompson character to be my like inroad into
why.
Well,
I think that's how they chose to do it, in order to not be like, because I think now, like if you made this story today for TV, you could make it somewhere at like Netflix or Stars or Showtime, where you could do a three-part series that's like Georgia Tan, anti-hero.
Yeah.
And you start out with her studying the law, and then you know, and then there's like the middle part of her life where she really thinks she is helping people.
Right.
And then it, you know, absolute power ends up corrupting.
Exactly. Ooh,
and, good. I mean, I'm going to play a long-ish clip that does sort of illustrate how exactly Georgia Tan and Camille Kelly were kind of colluding, but also rationalizing it. And while the listeners are listening to that, Piper, let's think about who we would cast as Georgia Tan if we remade this story today. Here's clip three.
Just going to wish I didn't have any food.
there's definitely this aspect to the way that Camille Kelly is portrayed that reminds me of The Judge and The Natural. Like, they sort of look the same, and there's this like fat cat smugness that they both have. Yeah, that's where they are with it, like, justification wise. And then Annie, Leah Thompson is just put in the position of like lobbing exposition softballs at the two villains. With that said, it's well paced in doing this. It, for a Lifetime movie, feels pretty straightforward. And like, there's a sequence, they've just been talking about this girl who has been taken away from her father because he's touching her inappropriately, or so they think. Leah Thompson wasn't asked to testify, and she's like concerned that, you know, proper channels weren't gone through. But you would expect that to drag on for like 20 minutes while she tries to figure it out and then question the kid. And it doesn't. So it does do some things, at least with alacrity. Like, the whole thing is under an hour and a half, at least. But it's a Lifetime movie. Like, you know, you go in expecting a certain thing, and mostly you get that. But because there is, this is like a little more sugar-free than the usual product, I enjoyed it. That is not to say that I was not sort of half listening while sourcing the outfits. The production design was really good, and Kathleen Quinlan in particular was wearing a number of cherry blossom print numbers that I was like, I need to own that. Perhaps Anthropology will have a sale on something like that. But yeah, I don't, I think this is like the only TV property about this person, but I think it could be redone and done better and more just like at more length, so that we're not coming in at the point of the story where Georgia Tan is already unalloyed bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of like characters, famous characters and famous, like kind of questionably heroic feminist characters that, you know, like it would be interesting to see portrayed that she kind of interacts with, you know, that would be good cameo parts for people.
Oh my God, like the June Allison and Dick Powell alone.
Oh my God. Yeah. Joan Crawford.
Yeah. Like, weren't twins split up?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm just like,
and then we all know how that turned out. Yeah, so
I'm looking to see if there are a couple of Georgia Tan books. I wonder if just like network developers start looking into this. There's The Baby Thief, The Untold Story of Georgia Tan.
That is the author who was interviewed in the Criminal episode. And of course that'll be in the show notes.
Okay. All right. All right. That looks like the only one too, or the most popular one. But yeah, it seems like maybe it is ripe for an adaptation. And I had an idea for who could play Georgia Tan later in her life. Okay. Part 2.5, maybe. Uh-huh. Aunt Dowd.
Yeah, that's the thought I had.
Ah, look at that.
Yeah. This is amazing. But who plays her earlier?
That I got stuck on.
Yeah, I'm still stuck on that too. Listeners, please share with us at Blotter Presents across social media who you think should play a young Georgia Tan or the older Georgia Tan. She died at 59 of uterine cancer, and died like as the government finally was like, fine, we'll open an investigation. Like, they just didn't want to deal with it. And Georgia Tan was like, you'll never get me, see? And died. And then I think the state was like kind of content to be like, well, that's a pity, and we're just going to avert our eyes from it. And that's more or less what happened. Again, the the criminal episode about this is a little more, gets a little more into the denouement after her death. But one thing that this movie is very concerned to do is to make sure, given that you've just been basking in a portrayal by Mary Tyler Moore, who, like, we all saw Ordinary People and we all watched the Sontae Kimes thing, but she's still Mary Tyler Moore, and they want to make sure you know that this person was a piece of shit. So here's the tip of the maltreatment of infants, Berg, in clip four. This is pretty stern stuff involving switching out a dead baby for a living one, so you may want to skip ahead like 5 minutes. There was really something bone chilling about, in a Lifetime movie with the, you know, sensitive piano tinkling away, having this woman be like, all right, cremate that one and we're going to use the other one. Like, it just really was like, whoa, like that'll focus your attention. And apparently this was not the only time, or even one time out of a dozen, that this happened. Like, at one point, I think in the criminal episode, they say that like 50 infants died in her care in the space of a month.
Oh my God.
So, yeah.
Like actual monster material. That is like a monster.
Yeah. And, like, but then, you know, but then there's like basically America's sweetheart, like throwing her beret in the air. So let's wrap up with one last clip. Georgia Tan has died by this time, and Annie has come to the children's home. And preceding this clip has been like a full 2 minutes of bereft baby actors sobbing, which, like, it like raises my heart rate. I can't take it. And then she comes upon a child of color who is scrubbing her skin with a brush. Why is she doing that? Because Georgia Tan sucks. Clip five. So, yeah, that dialogue is terrible, but, and yet it had that blunt force effectiveness, at least for me. Were you, like, taken aback by this material, or was the Lifetime packaging, like, too much for you to overcome?
I'm gonna go with B. Yeah, mm-hmm. These parts are cringeworthy too, because I didn't feel like 90s Lifetime, you know, despite their best efforts, were just like could talk about race and class in the way that we talk about it today, or people of color are, you know, given the platform to talk about it today. Like, that was a very white network back in 93.
Yes, that's so true.
I don't know. There is just something where I'm just like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if it holds up as, you know, the proper portrayal of, I just feel, even just like picturing just like a kind of everyday screenwriter that's just like churning out these like perfect murder stories, just like writing that line for a child and being like, oh, I don't know, that feels weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said before, like to say that this is good and I recommend it, like, I mean, I guess I recommend it if you are a Lifetime movie completist. It will not cost you any money to watch it. It's on YouTube. I'll link it in the show notes. And compared to what I expected, it was remarkably like not nearly as damp or as treacly as I was expecting, but it's still 90s Lifetime product. It is nice to look at. Like the print is terrible, but the outfits are fun to look at. This was an Emmy winning performance for Mary Tyler Moore. Accent aside, you can see why. Like she is convincing as this basically, you know, the sociopath at that point. But I think I liked it better than you did. But I also couldn't stop thinking about what it would look like today as a, whether it's a scripted drama or a documentary series. Would you rather watch a documentary about it made today or a like a Temple Grandin type of thing?
I'm into this. I'm into a scripted movie, biographical movie, because too of just like, we're still not there with like a three-parter with a leading woman of a certain age as a villain. Like when do we do that? That I don't think that's ever existed. So I'm like, all right. Of just like, I don't know. Like the tricky thing is just like, it's going to be very hard to make her sympathetic considering all the crap she pulled. But
you raise an interesting point because think about the sheer volume of material just on various TV networks, or from various TV concerns, concerning Ted Bundy. So,
or Bernie Madoff, of just like, there were like three made for TV movies about Bernie Madoff, which I enjoy. Ted Bundy. I mean, the amount of just like, That's right. And they're all just like actor vehicles for men to show their range.
Yeah, like I can be creepy. And it's not that they're wrong to consider that an opportunity for themselves. Like they're actors and that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But there's also like, I don't know, like that she must have had a certain compelling charisma and like savvy to be able to do this. For decades it went on. And meanwhile, I mean, I don't know if this Boston marriage element of her personal life was an open secret or what, but in
Tennessee,
like during the Depression, like how are you getting by with any of this? Like this was not an unclever person. This was not an off-putting person. And yet, and the other thing is like that when a woman is responsible for a lot of deaths, it tends to be with, you know, it tends to be children or child adjacent, Warnos accepted. So like, I don't know if I'm a development executive, like it just, I don't know. Like, I don't know if we want to stick our hand in this crazy.
But it is an interesting thing, too, because now that I'm thinking about it, of just like, I will watch like a Ted Bundy, Bernie Madoff movie and not need to know why they did what they did. Like, I don't need like what happened in their past. I'm just like, they're crazy and like that's compelling. But like, I wonder how this story would be told, like if there would have to be some kind of like reasoning for who she is, or if like the writers and performers can pull off just like, no, she is just dark as hell, of just like, she is Ted Bundy. Like, depending, I don't really know enough about her past, I should just read the book, but But yeah, if there's no explanation, I'm almost like think that could be more interesting to see and more of like a challenge to the notions that viewers have about villainous women. So
yeah. There's also the criminal episode mentions that she, in some cases, blackmailed adoptive parents whom she'd worked with, particularly the ones in Tennessee, to she'd just come back around and be like, give me $500. And they're like, what? No. Like, the baby's fine. We're done here. And she's like, well, the thing is that this was somewhat irregular and I can't take the baby back. And like, she would have probably blown up her own spot by doing that. But these parents, like, this is their kid now.
Right.
So they're like, okay, 1937, like, evil lady, we'll try to, you know, we'll sell a kidney and get you the money. Like, she, you have to wonder how much of it was having been thwarted at her first prospective career, how much of this was like a defiant making of her own way at the expense of the gender roles of the time.
Right.
This is not a defense of her. She was and is a piece of shit, and I hope she rots, but you have to wonder how, like, how she was like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to strike out on my own. Like,
yeah,
ripping families apart and letting infants die. Like, I don't think anyone starts out with that in the Slack room.
No.
You get there somehow because of some dark water. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I want it. I want that show. I want that update. I think that that could be, I'm sold on that now.
Yeah, no, me too. All right, well then let's flip the question and ask who is going to make the project, because I mean, not to nominate Erin Lee Carr for everything. She's got a couple of things going on.
Well, I was going to say HBO, it's such an HBO. It's such a like Olive Kittredge kind of thing, right? Like a three-part, yes, like complicated woman epic saga thing that's real good. Yeah, I can see. So maybe it is like Erin Lee Carr's, yeah, venture into scripted.
Or she could, or Bart Layton, who did both The Imposter and American
Animals,
who I think found a really good way to split the difference between using real life figures in talking heads and doing reenactments with not just like whoever's around, but name actors like, what's his face from American Crime Story? Evan Peters. There it is. So,
yep.
Yeah, one of them, but I think Erin Lee Carr has enough experience with, complicated women whose motivations are really tangled and like gnarly to look at, that I would love to see her take a run at this.
And maybe even like another idea is like Jennifer Kent, of just like Babadook horror movie.
Yes.
Understands like the darkness inside of us and just like this weird relationship to children flipped on its head.
Yes.
I was that. She pulls no punches, so.
Yeah. And get Essie Davis to be young Georgia Tan. She can do anything, in my opinion.
Look at that. Look at, we're doing all the hard work.
Yeah, we solved it.
Out.
Bang. We solved documentary filmmaking. Ask us anything. Well, now I'm mad that that's not actually going to happen. Maybe we need to like write someone a letter. I don't know.
I know. This is such an of the moment cause. Yeah. I think that's the petition that we need to be working on right now.
Yeah, for sure. Nothing else going on. Let's get after it.
Yeah.
All right. You're obviously not working on anything else except this, but before we leave you, Piper, where else can people find you and what you're working on?
Oh gosh. I've been tweeting a little bit here and there these days at the Piper Weiss. and I'm on Instagram under Piper Weiss. Nothing that interesting being posted up there, but I live there virtually. And then I wrote a book called You All Grow Up and Leave Me, True Crime Memoir. And hopefully I'll write another one someday.
Yeah. Speaking of Get After It, yeah, the first one's great. Oh, more, please.
Very kind. So tired, though. So tired.
I get it. Thank you so much for coming back.
You're the best. Thanks You're for having best. Me.
We are the best.
You're amazing.
Soon you'll be hearing Phoebe Judge talking to Kevin Smokler, but before we get into that, a word from our sponsor, Sundance Now. Life is often stranger than fiction. Maybe that's one reason we're drawn to true crime, the stories even Hollywood couldn't come up with. One of the reasons I'm drawn to true crime is the same reason I like crosswords and jigsaw puzzles. Completing the picture, filling in all the details. Whether that's the attraction for you, you're fascinated by the psychology of criminals, or you're looking for new takes on notorious cases, you have to check out Sundance Now, because Sundance Now will have something for you. Sundance Now is a commercial-free streaming service brought to you by the folks at AMC Network. So if you love their groundbreaking storytelling, you'll love Sundance Now and its killer selection. Don't get up, I'll fire myself. Of true crime series you won't find anywhere else. Sundance Now's true crime offerings cover everything from the unheard of to the infamous. From Joe Berlinger's underrated cold-blooded The Clutter Family Murders, on the case that created a genre within Cold Blood, to The Preppy Murder, on the death of Jennifer Levin and the case that consumed a city. And Sundance Now has features as well as series, including Oscar nominees like The Act of Killing, and internet sleuth investigation doc, The Thread. And you can watch Sundance Now on all your favorite devices. Just download the app or watch online for as low as $4.99 a month. That's a steal given all that exclusive content. Check it all out and discover your next binge-worthy show on Sundance Now. Try Sundance Now free for 30 days by going to sundancenow.com with my promo code BLOTTER. That's sundancenow.com code BLOTTER, BLOTTER, to get your first 30 days for free. Thanks, Sundance Now. Just a quick note about the sound in the second portion of the episode. A hat trick of issues descended upon the three of us as we sat down to record Kevin Smokler's interview with Phoebe Judge. So, between windy rainstorm Wi-Fi, Kevin's headset crapping out, Skype having a series of its spells, coaxing listenable audio out of the conversation was more challenging than usual. I hope you will forgive a certain old-timey flair to the proceedings and focus on the content. Thank you for your patience. Here's the interview. In today's cold case section, I'm turning the reins over once again to the Blotter Presents' interviewer at large, Kevin Smokler. Today, Kevin is speaking to Phoebe Judge, host and co-creator of the podcasts Criminal and This Is Love, and I'm doing my best to stay out of the way. Kevin, over to you.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Phoebe, it's so great to talk to you.
Well, I'm happy to do it.
I feel like we have a number of friends in common and have been in the same room or auditorium before, but I'm not sure we've ever formally met. I am really curious because I've been listening to Criminals since even before you guys were allied with Radiotopia, just because I've enjoyed the subject and the show so much. I'm wondering if you could sort of give us the Law and Order cold open of where Criminal came from.
Well, in 2013, Lauren Spohr, my co-creator, and I were working in public radio on a public radio program called The Story with Dick Gordon, and I was a guest host and doing interviews, and I had been a reporter, and Lauren had been a producer and a director and an editor, and we'd been working together on this show. That show was taken off the air. We were sitting outside that night, and Lauren looked at me. She said, you know, people who listen to public radio also watch Law and Order. They may not want to admit it, but they do. And why don't we do a show about crime? At that time, there really were no other true crime podcasts. Serial wouldn't come out for another 12 months or so. And so we didn't really have any competition. But what we did know is that a lot of the true crime reporting that we were seeing out there, we disagreed with. We disagreed with the sensationalizing of violence. We disagreed with the complete lack of empathy towards the victims. We disagreed with a lot of the ways it was done. And we wanted to try to do something different. And that's how Criminal was born.
How would you describe your interest in the genre of true crime, just as an ordinary person and not a journalist?
Well, the honest truth is I'm interested in 5,000 other things as much as I'm interested in crime. Crime makes an awful good story, though, and these are stories that are so rich and so challenging to tell, but challenging in the best way. But I've often said that if people are just true crime fans, they might be disappointed listening to Criminal, because Criminal, I think, is more accurately a show about the human experience. Now, what we tried to do when we said we were going to make a crime show is push the boundaries of what that word crime means. So in episodes of Criminal, sometimes they'll be very funny and sometimes they'll be dark, but we're always trying to push the word crime and see how far we can stretch it and what we can do to surprise the listeners with that word.
Yeah, granted, the word crime is in the title of the show, but I almost think of Criminal as a sibling or a cousin of either Planet Money or Marketplace, where the subject, there's an ostensible subject, but it's refractory. The idea is to see how many different kinds of stories one can tell with that subject is sort of the prism that turns this way and that and catches the light in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've never heard our show compared to either of those shows, but I think that's a perfect way to think about it.
You guys have been, and tell me if I have this right. You guys have been on a twice a month schedule pretty much since the beginning of the show's run. Is that correct?
Yes, we've never missed a release date, and we've never taken a break.
138 episodes in—that's saying a lot. Could you take us through what is sort of your production schedule to maintain that pace, and then like zoom in a little bit to show us one for a single episode?
Sure. I mean, I would love to say that we're working six episodes out, and at the time that we're recording this, I mean, certainly the world seems a little different, so everything's changed a bit. But you know, usually we are working on the episode furiously that's just going to come out that next week. I would say most episodes take a whole, you know, somewhere from 7 to 14 days to construct. We are recording interviews for episodes that might come out later, and we certainly are doing research and trying to book guests at the same time we might be editing the current episode. But what usually happens, we have a pretty small staff. For the amount of content we put out, I think that we've done that very deliberately, just because Lauren and I are both so trolling, we could never give up touching every part of it. I think this show we have worked on for so long and fought so hard for, so we just kept it really small. But one of us will suggest a story topic and kind of pass it around, and we'll say yay or nay. And if enough people like it, then we'll reach out to the guests and see if they're interested. And then an interview is booked, or maybe sometimes a few interviews, and I do the interview. We talk before the interview and write cue lines and do the interview. And then after that, someone will take the first lead on writing the first draft of a script. We go through about 3 or 4 script drafts before we get to the tracking process. Most of the time, a criminal script starts out at around 50 minutes, and we pare it down to anywhere between, you know, 25 and 30. That's just usually what it turns out to be. We'll track the episode. Then one of us will mix it. And then we'll send it off to be mastered by our engineer. So the whole process takes pretty much, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks. And we always publish at 4 a.m. On Friday morning before it comes out. We don't wait up, but we schedule it for that. And that's kind of the from start to finish. If we just most recently put out an episode about something called Starlight Tours in Saskatchewan, about a rash of First Nations men who were driven out to the edge of town in the middle of winter in Saskatoon and left by the police to kind of walk home. Many of them died. It was a complicated story because we didn't want to get anything wrong, but we were dealing with reporters. We were dealing with wanting to fact check. We also have a fact checker. So the script goes to a fact checker, but that took four edits of a script and a multi-hour edits with us all sitting around: Lauren Spohr, me, Susanna Robertson, our assistant producer, and Nadia Wilson, our senior producer, and going through line by line, to make sure that everything checked out. There are other stories that we do where it's just one woman. I'm thinking of Paulette Cooper, who stowed away on a cruise ship in the 60s. And that was just one interview I did with Paulette. And that was a pretty simple script to write because it was just cutting down that one interview and putting in some other details. But no one was going back into legal history for that one. So it just depends on the topic.
I have long been curious. Like I know like there's no felonies only requirement for your show. Like there, you have an episode about you have a famous episode about streaking, and you have a famous episode about crimes that are property crimes or crimes that do not involve violence or a human victim. But I'm wondering like does a crime simply have to have an interesting narrative attached to it to be a criminal episode, or is there something about the type of crime beyond its potential storytelling riches that grabs you guys?
No, I think oftentimes I'll suggest something and where's the crime in that? That happened just yesterday, and I said, well, you know, Lauren, we can also do stories about moral crime. Ethical crimes. But, you know, there's certainly no one type or a specific type of crime. It has to touch tangentially on the subject. We don't want to get too wild here with our interpretation of the word crime. But there isn't what's so wonderful, and I think what has allowed us to continue the show at the rate it has, now 138 episodes in, is because we are an anthology show. We don't cover the same thing weeks and weeks, you know, multiple episodes. I mean, we've done a two-parter before. And that means that it's always surprising to us and fresh for us and keeps our interest, because every 2 weeks we allow ourselves to switch to our next curiosity. And in thinking about the stories that we put out, we're very aware of a number of different factors, like have we done too many dark stories in a row? Do we have male narrators? Have we had a number of male narrators in a row? How many stories have we done recently that just involve white people? How many stories have we done that are just coming out of California, XYZ? And so we're always thinking about the variety and range, and that's what we like. So we don't ever just look for one type or have a certain special thing that we're interested in. I think we're curious about it all.
It seems to me that if you take sort of the Radiotopia universe and you look very hard at the shows, you can kind of see how the staffing and makeup of different programs affects the program's output, i.e. how it sounds and when the experience received by the listener. 99PI is a show voiced by Roman, but it now has a series of producers that have all kind of declared, not out loud, but by the episodes they've handled, their interests. And the subjects kind of jump around based on who is taking the lead that week. The Illusionist very much sounds like the show, a show produced of one sensibility and of one person. I'm wondering if you can step away from Criminal as something you produce. Is it the product of two people who had worked together before, had been colleagues on an entirely different journalistic enterprise before they started this one?
Criminal wouldn't exist without Lauren's input. I mean, I I don't even like thinking about the idea that of having to make the show without her involvement. While there is certainly a host of the program, and it's my voice and it's my temperament in asking the questions and the interviews and my personality, it is a show that is a co-creation and was conceived of that way in the beginning. Lauren's hands are throughout every word that goes on the page. Also now so thankful that we have two other producers who get to talk about, you know, show their interest in the stories that we pick and the way that the narratives are constructed. That's been so lucky, and it's taken a long time to find the exact right fit to people to join the team. But I think that while this is a co-creation, this is a show that was dreamt up out of both of our curiosities. And I might just be more comfortable on the mic than she is, but no, this is, I don't like to think about, and I don't think the show could continue without Lauren's involvement. It doesn't work.
One of the things that speaks to the really consistently high quality of Criminal, and really one of the things I think most of its devoted fans, including myself, respond to, is that the sort of stations of the cross of true crime are very obvious and very twice told. I'm mixing a few metaphors there, but there's three or four different ways to approach a true crime story, and at this point they all feel like cliches, and somehow Criminal manages not to. And I think it begins with your narration, which is not cold and analytical in a forensic files kind of way, and it's not high-handed and self-righteous in a Nancy Grace kind of way. The word that speaks to me is curious, but I'm wondering from your point of view how you see how you position the narration and the voice of the program.
Well, I think curious is right, and I certainly wouldn't fight you saying that, because I'm glad to think that that's what it sounds like. The greatest compliment we've received, luckily a lot of compliments and descriptors about Criminal, but someone once said, Criminal is a quiet show. Criminal is a calm show. And that to me was the best thing that I've heard said about the show. When we started the show, we very quickly decided that we weren't going to be in the judgment game, that we had no interest in deciphering good or bad or right or wrong, that we were as interested in talking to people who had committed crimes as people who had been victims of crimes and people's lives who had been touched by crime, that really all we were trying to do is figure out why people do the things they do and what brings them to the position up to the point where they might even commit a crime. And for me, I'm not in the gotcha game, and I'm not in the judgment game or the conclusion, you know, we're going to wrap this up. That's not my job. And that's the listeners, if they like, job. My job is to present as much information as I can in the most compelling way that I can. And also in doing that, I have to understand that the person who's giving me their time in sitting down and talking to me needs to feel respected, and they need to feel appreciated. And the last thing in the world that anyone needs to feel is that someone else's agenda is being pushed on them. And so for me, I go into all of these conversations just really actually with a complete curiosity. And I'm not trying to push someone to admit or to reflect on. Really, I just am interested in why we do the things we do. And I think I hope that comes through, is that I don't get off on feeling better about myself because I can be judgmental about someone else. And I don't want to be involved in a show that does that. I don't believe in evil, and I don't believe that people are intrinsically bad. And I don't think that anyone on this who works on this show believes that. That's our worldview. People get themselves in terrible situations and they do horrible things. But we're not bad people. And so we're interested in what are the factors and what make people do these terrible things. And that's kind of what we take to every episode.
You are from Chicago, right?
Yes.
When I was researching, I was actually a little surprised to find that out because I had gotten the sense from listening to the story a long time ago and now listening to Criminal since the very beginning that your experience of as a journalist in North Carolina strikes me as so deep and rich that I just thought you were a native instead of an immigrant to those lands. I figured like you and Rhiannon Giddens had gone to high school together or something. And I'm curious if that, how practicing journalism, not where you grew up, has informed your perspective as a journalist.
Well, this is the first time I will tell you that I have ever been mistaken for growing up in the South before being a southerner. You know, my experience in North Carolina, I don't think has really taught me how to be a journalist. What really taught me how to be a journalist, and certainly as an outsider going in, was the years that I spent in Mississippi. I was the Gulf Coast reporter for Mississippi Public Broadcasting right after Hurricane Katrina and up through the BP oil spill, and I was dropped down in Gulfport, Mississippi. I barely knew that Mississippi had a coastline. I'd spent no time in the South. I had lived, obviously grown up in Chicago and went to school in Vermont and spent time on Cape Cod. So it was brand new. And there I was in the deep South and spent 2.5 years reporting every day. That was the real education for me. And I think that you could fall on two camps in that idea that it's good to know the place because you get the nuance and you know the history. And sometimes it's good to just show up fresh. But that really, that was a real learning experience for me. And we do live in North Carolina. We make the show here, but I'm still sometimes surprised myself that I'm still living in the South all these years later because it wasn't something that I saw. I didn't see myself continuing on here much after my stint in Mississippi.
What assumptions are made about the Criminal team as journalists? What assumptions are made about a group of journalists who have taken on crime as a subject for the last 6+ years? What conclusions, true and false, are drawn about you guys when you meet people who are new to the show?
Well, I think that there's an assumption that you're obsessed with crime, or true crime is all you do or all you think about, which isn't exactly right for us. I mean, we have a love show. I think that there's an assumption that you somehow have some sort of authoritative voice on the criminal justice system, which I'll tell you, doing this now for this many years, I'm more confused about the justice system in this country than before I ever started. And also that you have some insight on kind of people's ability. What makes people do bad things? You know, those are three things that people think that we spend a lot of time thinking about. And I, you know, for me, it's more about the story. And I don't sit up. People say all the time, oh, it must be so hard for you. How do you escape it? You spend your whole, all day, every day, you know, thinking about violence and murder. And I think well, that's very, very, very wrong. For us, though, it's very important that we are considered journalists. That is what we are. Of course, in some ways, we're entertainers as well, and that has to be appreciated. But I would never say that was the first thing that we are. We take great pride in the reporting that we do on Criminal. We don't do stories that we can't fact check. We're very aware of putting out false information. We're very aware of speculating. We don't speculate on Criminal. I sometimes hear these in true crime. You'll see people and they'll be speculating about what someone's last moments were like before the person came in with the knife as they were cowering in the closet. And I just hear that sometimes, or I read that and I just think, how do you know? And certainly in the true crime genre, I think, That's that's bold of you to do. And I think that that's very popular. And I think there's a reason people do it. I don't think that we'd be very good at that, because I don't think we just know how to do that. And I think I would like criminal to be thought of as a journalistic endeavor before anything else.
That is really the impression I get listening to it. And I think I think the reason that it speaks to me in that way as a listener is because though your voice as the narrator is very distinctive, it's also very sparse. You will often find an interview subject or a character in the story and let them do the majority of the narrating of the story. And you will show up sparingly to frame it. Tell me about that aesthetic choice.
I feel more strongly about that than maybe I do about speculating on violence. I say the best episodes of Criminal are the ones where you hear me the least. Then we know we've got a really good story. I think that I'm the least interesting person in the world. I think we should probably all think that about ourselves, and that the person we're talking to are the interesting ones. So for me, when I'm in, I don't want to hear me talk. I'm so curious. I just want to hear about other people's experience. And I also believe, I like to shut up. I like to let someone else talk and hear where they're going. But I also believe that people are very perceptive about picking up on ulterior motives. Or so when I'm interviewing someone, if I am trying very hard to get them to say something or to get somewhere, people are going to pick up on that. And I don't think it leads to a good conversation. I also think that people are very aware whether you're listening closely or not. And if people can tell, we can tell this just in our daily lives. We know if we're telling someone a story and they're not really, they don't care, they're not paying attention. It's very clear. And what that does is it makes us, clam up. It makes us think to ourselves, well, listen, if you don't care, I'm not going to go deep into, I'm not going to tell you this very important thing. If I can tell you're half listening. So we've tried to, I try in all my interviews, one, to be very curious and to listen, but also to not talk to someone for 3 hours. If I'm going to start to fade and they're going to start to fade, well, let's talk, I talk to people for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half at the most. But what I found is that if you're genuinely curious in what someone's going to say in their answer, you can ask some, I have found, I can ask someone anything. So I sometimes ask questions that I'll see Nadia or Lauren in the control room and their mouths will drop because maybe the bluntness or the boldness of it. But I've never had anyone not answer something. And I hope that that's not some great skill of mine. I think it's just because I think the person can see that I'm really just interested in what they might say. And I'm not really being judgmental. I'm just very curious.
Based on what you just said, that you a great episode is where we hear you, the narrator, or the host, the least. The 100th episode, where you had people, where you had fans of the show call in and try and mimic your voice as best they could. Mm-hmm. The line of dialogue, if we can call it that most people used was sort of the station ID that you put in at a distinct point, which is, I'm Phoebe Judge, this is Criminal. And I understand the narrative reason for that. We sort of want to remind people what we're listening to and that we're transitioning from the prologue to act one of the story. I just think it's an interesting choice because of what you just said, that the show that you try very hard to not make the show about you. So I'm curious about that choice and about where you place it in a script, because it appears in a slightly different place every episode.
Well, I think it really, the whole I'm Phoebe Judge, this is Criminal thing, which has kind of taken on a life of its own. But really, it just started because when we started the show, we knew that we wanted to start the show with our subject's voice, with someone else's voice, not with my own. And to start the show, just kind of get right into it. And so that was why, we thought, okay, well, we're not going to hear from me until we've heard from the guest and get a little bit into the show. And of course, we had to identify the show in some way. So we would, at some point, I need to say who I was and the show title that you were listening to, just for clarity's sake. We use the Phoebe Judge as you say, the prologue, and I think that that's fair to say, though sometimes we really push it and we'll look at each other and say, oh, can we actually put the Phoebe Judge on page 8? I mean, we are really, really pushing this. It comes pretty late sometimes. But what we used the paragraph before the Phoebe Judge as kind of the thesis statement, the here's what's coming. And it moves because sometimes it just depends on how much we wanted to tell you before you have that minute. When you hear the Phoebe Judge, it's really just a way for someone, I hope, to have the second to say, digest all the information they've just heard and get ready because we're going to keep going. It's a break point. It's a page turn. It's a just a stop for a second. And depending on the complexity of the story or depending on how we want the information to be laid out is how we determine where that Phoebe Judge is going to go.
We all know that the idea of someone being named Dennis and becoming and being more likely to become a dentist when they grow up is nonsense. I'm sure, despite that, you guys gave some thought to someone with the last name Judge being the host of a show about crime.
You know, it's so funny. We didn't think about it. It wasn't real. I mean, my association thought that my sensibilities and my sparseness and my voice would lead well to a crime show. But the fact that I am named Phoebe Judge, it just happens to be a total coincidence. People think it's funny. I mean, I think it probably hasn't hurt the show that the host name is Judge. But it's not anything that we thought, oh, wait, well, we'll get some interest. It'll be easy for people to remember the show Criminal because the host is named Judge. That never came. We never even thought about that until maybe the second episode when someone wrote in and said, whoa, that's kind of funny that you've got this crime show with a girl named Judge.
That someone might have been me. Full disclosure. Then again, I'm not really a birder and I don't play baseball. So there's only so much destiny in the names, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I did an article on young people and pipe smoking recently, and I had to answer a half dozen questions about whether I was using some sort of jaunty pseudonym because my last name is Smokler to write this story about tobacco and young people. Criminal comes from Criminal as a show begins before Serial, which in the history of podcasting is like beginning before indoor plumbing. I'm wondering if, given how crowded the field of true crime podcasts and true crime entertainment itself has become, has that changed how you guys report and select stories for episodes?
No. That's we made Criminal the same way we made Criminal when we started. It actually looks pretty, the production process looks pretty much the same as it did all those years ago. I'm still as terrified that we're going to lose all our listeners today as I was during the first episode. And we're still at the studio on Sunday, and we're still wringing our hair out over one line or where that Phoebe Judge does go. We keep our heads down here and do good work and don't worry much what anyone else is doing. I don't know. Is there another anthology crime show as ours?
Yeah, I think there are pretenders to it, but.
Yeah, we don't feel competition. Think I've heard anything like Criminal out there, and I'm not trying to be cavalier in saying that. I don't think that there's anything, because I haven't heard anything like us yet. Certainly there's wonderful true crime out there that is filling great gaps and doing work that we don't do, totally different types of crime shows. And I've been so happy to see this well-reported journalistic endeavors and these new crime shows come up, because I think it's just great and makes me happy to be part of the true crime genre. But we don't worry about what other people are doing. We just keep doing what I think we've always done.
I think part of that is that Criminal does report, most Criminal episodes are stories that you can fairly safely assume that the listener has not heard before. I mean, maybe someone reading the local newspaper or the local online news source in the area where that story happened. You guys overlap very, very lightly with sort of the true crime industrial complex. In that only occasionally will you take on topics or stories that have achieved a more iconic status in the universe of true crime. The examples that come immediately to mind are the Ken McElroy story or the Georgia Tan story or the two-parter you did on the murder of Sanford White. How do you guys report on a crime story that has been well reported as opposed to the majority of your episodes, which are stories that are probably known locally, but not beyond that?
Well, as you say, we don't do it often. In terms of the Georgia Tan story, which is the story of a really kind of, she might have been evil. I know I just said I don't believe in evil, but a woman who was stealing babies and selling them to families who were desperate for a child of their own. The take we took on that was that the author who we interviewed for that story was an adoptive mother herself. And after researching, Georgia Tan had thought to herself her own guilt in taking her child potentially away from the adoptive parents or the birth parents, and the relationship that her daughter had had or hadn't had with her birth parents. And also she had gone on a quest to hunt down victims of Georgia Tan's and put things in the newspaper and such. And so that was a way, I hope, that we could tell a little bit of a different twist to the Georgia Tan story. But we're always looking for that twist. Ken McElroy, that's a story that I guess might be pretty well known, man who terrorized a town, Skidmore. But to me, that was a story that I had no idea about. And so I was just coming to that completely fresh. And for those types of stories, what we need, and for Sanford White too, is you really just need a compelling narrator, not me, a compelling narrator of the story. And so you need someone who's really invested in the story in some way that will help you, help the listener maybe get past the fact that, wait a second, have I heard this before? But we really do shy away from stories that have been reported widely in the mainstream media. It actually makes it easier for us to just take those off the table.
There's a particular danger, I think, in reporting a well-told true crime story as if it is new. And I have been critical of other true crime podcasts who come along with a kind of cavalier naivete and say things like, you heard about this Ted Bundy guy? Wow. Effectively. And I think you guys, the way you guys succeed is not only in the depth of reporting, but tonally, there's an idea that you discovering the story is never part of the telling of the story.
Yeah, I mean, we aren't investigators and we don't pretend to be. The stories that we do, we aren't cracking the case here. Really, what we're trying to do is explore how the case was cracked, or the lives of the people that were involved, or how the events lay up to getting to the point where this event happened. That to us is, or maybe the inside perspective of the person that you hadn't heard yet, who you'd heard about this event, but you never heard their side of it. That's the approach that we take. And the idea of having to do a deep investigation while we talk about that, while I think that might be something that we take on in the future. But in the type of show that we do with the production schedule that we have, I think it would be very overwhelming. And I admire the shows that are out there that do it in a responsible way. But for us, we wouldn't ever begin to let someone think that we had done more than we had.
The Georgia Tan episode of your show is the one I listened to the most times. And then I realized I was listening to it repeatedly just so I could be angry and self-righteous about what an evil person this was. And then I had to stop because I was heading down a dangerous corridor. That is the only time in 138 episodes that I could almost tell that you, as the narrator, held the subject of the story in some kind of contempt, deservedly so. I'm wondering if that was intentional, if that came out in early drafts of putting that story together, or was that something that I am realizing only in retrospect?
Georgia Tan bragged that she had a rigorous selection process that matched the perfect child with the perfect home. But she wanted her customers to be happy, so sometimes she'd send three children to the same family and let them have a one-year trial to decide which, if any, they'd like to keep. In correspondence with her attorney, children were referred to as merchandise, quote, in hand and in stock.
No, I think that I'm trying to go through the list of episodes of in my head and think about other people who might have. It's not, if that came out, I think Georgia Tan, one could argue, had a very tough childhood and was probably suffering from a mental illness of some sort. The way that she operated. So I wasn't trying to show too much contempt towards her, but we will sometimes, when we're going through a draft and we're listening to there's a question of mine that's been left in, we'll look at each other and say, you know, is that too much? You know, should we take Phoebe out, or is she showing? Because it also raises our ears when I do show in any sense an opinion. One thing I will call out, though, is absurdity and wildness in things. And so while I don't want to be judgmental, when things are just really pretty wild, I will say it. And I don't want the listener to think that I'm just sitting passively by and letting people say whatever they want without, I'm a human, you know, and certainly, but Georgia Tan, I think that I'm trying to remember back to the editing process. And if there was a point where Lauren or Nadia looked at me and said, Phoebe, is that okay if we leave that in, or is that too much? Probably that would be an episode where I certainly would have had an opinion.
I did my back research, much of it, in spending time at your website. And I haven't done that before because largely I listen to your episodes as they come in on my podcast feed. But I noticed that not only do you say in the credits of the show that Julian Alexander does original illustrations for every episode, but you've got the website laid out so the illustration, the sort of single image, single black and white image that Julian Alexander does, has to carry a lot of the storytelling weight for what that particular episode is about. I'm curious as to the choice behind pairing those illustrations with the audio product that is Criminal.
Well, you know, she's been making illustrations since day one of Criminal, before we could pay her anything. What I've always been interested in is the aesthetic, maybe I could be so bold as to use that word, of Criminal. And what I hope is that the aesthetic of the art, the aesthetic of the narration, my voice, the sparseness, it all works, even the logo. And so when I look at the website and I see those illustrations, I think it all works together. And she's given a script when she creates his illustrations, and sometimes will also suggest something, you know, how about this or that, but then we let her kind of go for it. And the continuity of 138 illustrations being with 138 episodes, I just love to look at, and I love the art so much. And I think the sparseness of the art matches the show perfectly. And so when designing the website, you know, we thought, why not highlight the art that has kind of gone hand in hand since the beginning with the description of these stories?
Yeah, it manages to be black and white, sparse, and yet not sort of exhaustively noirish, You know, it doesn't come from sort of a true crime playbook of any kind.
Yeah, there's not many people depictions of trench coats and, you know, fedoras. But I think that the black and white matches it all, matches the whole idea of it all. I think it all fits together nicely, and I like that so much about the brand of criminal.
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying that emotionally, one of the missions of criminal is a look into the sort of trapdoors and sliding panels of the human soul, the darkness of it, and the things we would prefer not to think about each other.
Yes, and I also think a look at the resiliency of the human spirit and finding joy in things that might be considered dark. I think the surprise of it all, the surprise of living a human life and how often we might be able to walk a line which we think is safe and we think ourselves good moral people, but how easily it is to maybe step over into that other side, and how we should be wary of casting judgment on anyone before we hear what makes people do the things they actually do.
It almost ties criminal thematically or mission-wise to criminal's younger sibling, which is This Is Love, the other podcast you guys do. I sometimes wonder if you know, This Is Love, it's on its third season now, and I sometimes wonder if you and the criminal team were sitting down and saying, okay, we've taken on crime, which is a subject everybody has preconceived ideas about, and we foiled those preconceived ideas. Let's take on an even bigger yet often trod target like love and see if we can do the same thing. Tell me if I'm right or wrong.
I think that was probably the exact conversation. let's take this subject, which is so often reported on and so often talked about, and people have these ideas of what it is, and let's turn it on its head a little bit. And let's do a whole love show about animals and not talk once about the idea of romantic love, as we're doing right now with this current season. Or let's just go to Italy and do a whole love show in Italy. You know, I think that's what we were hoping to do. And also, I think making the love show has made criminal better. I think that it's helping with criminal because it's giving us something else to think about besides just these crime stories, but it's informing the criminal stories in a way, with a sensitivity that I think has been there from the beginning, but maybe is coming out even more now that we are doing these two shows at once.
I think any job in which you can be like, let's go to Italy as a research statement, you're doing something right, I would say.
I had one last question, which I can already tell I'm going to ask it badly. So I'm curious if Criminal was, say, like a mystery novel, like, would you want it to continue on as is until you guys grew tired of it? In other words, is it where you'd like it to be, or would you like at some point in the near or distant future for there to be a big plot twist, a giant infusion of money or some other thing that happened to take the show in a completely different direction?
Well, if we were tempted by money, we would have done things differently. I'm interested in staying engaged and what I do every day. And I think we all feel that. And so for us, why we decided to start the love show is because we need to challenge ourselves again. And so what I firmly, and now we've started a show where I'm reading a mystery novel and I read a chapter a day, and that's going on right now. And that's given us something else. If we weren't busy enough, now we do that. And I firmly expect that in the next few months, we will endeavor on another project that maybe builds on Criminal, but is different, But I hope that Criminal will continue just as is. I don't see any good reason to change it much. I hope the stories keep getting richer and better, and we keep getting better at making them, and that we have the good fortune to be able to keep doing this. I mean, I'm so thankful that people have stayed with us for all these years and still listen to us. I don't take any of that for granted, that the fact that we have listeners, because there's so much stuff to listen to. And so the fact that someone would choose to listen to our show means an awful lot to me.
I subscribe to 183 podcasts because I'm not well. And but still, that means there's about six that when they arrive get listened to first. Everything else waits in a pretty long line. And your show is amongst those six. So that's just my way of saying thank you, and I really appreciate you speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. Criminal has followed me across five different phones, so you're definitely doing something right from where I'm sitting. And thanks again for taking the time.
Thank you all very much.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Allison Lohuff returns to talk about an investigator, Jessica Lees returns to talk about The Last Narc, and Memorial Day returns, and I'm taking the week off. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews and blotter briefs, DE briefs, so sign up today. Today's episode was also sponsored by Sundance Now, so don't forget to visit sundancenow.com and use that promo code BLOTTER. My guest has been Piper Weiss, and she's on Twitter at @ThePiperWeiss. You can find Kevin Smokler on Twitter at @Ouija, and Criminal is on Twitter at @CriminalShow. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.